This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of The Overcomers, God's Vision for You to Thrive in an Age of Anxiety and Outrage, written and narrated by pastor and best-selling author Matt Chandler, and is available everywhere audiobooks are sold.
Hey folks, welcome to another episode of Footnotes, helping you become a more informed neighbor, advocate, and believer. I'm your host, Dr. Jamar Tisby, and you are in for a treat this episode because I don't often get to travel internationally, but this episode is all about my journey to Northern Ireland. I'm just as surprised as you are that I got to journey to Northern Ireland. So I'm going to tell you about why I went and who I was with. I'm going to tell you what we did, and I'm going to tell you some takeaways from it. Now, I've got to give you a heads up front. There is a complicated history here. So we went in particular to study what they call in Northern Ireland, the Troubles. That's a euphemism for the violent conflict that lasted approximately 30 years from 1968 to 1998 between Catholics and Protestants. Now, when we use those terms, don't think primarily religious or theological. There were some elements of religious and theological conflict there, but those terms in Northern Ireland, Catholic and Protestant, when you use them, people are going to first of all think about political sides. So the island of Ireland is divided into two countries. The Republic of Ireland, of which Dublin is the capital, and it has the flag of green and white and orange. And then Northern Ireland, which the capital is Belfast, and they're politically part of the United Kingdom, whereas the Republic of Ireland is its own nation. So that is the distinction. When I say Northern Ireland, I don't just mean in the northern part of the island, it was, but I'm talking about the political state or country of Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, but that's the conflicted part. That's the contested part. So when you say Catholics and Catholics versus Protestant in the Troubles, the Catholic portion or population of Northern Ireland wants to be part of the Republic of Ireland. And so Catholics are also sometimes referred to as Republicans. Republicans, not at all in the United States context, but Republican in the sense of wanting to join with the Republic of Ireland. On the other side are Protestants, who are mainly coming from Britain and or the UK, and they want to remain united with the United Kingdom. So they're sometimes called Unionists. Catholics are sometimes called Nationalists because they want their own nation. Protestants are sometimes called Loyalists because they want to remain loyal to the crown. So it is an absolute stew of terms. But when I say Catholic and Protestant on this episode, I'm referring to those sort of sectarian divides that led to the Troubles, and those were the two main sides in the Troubles. There's a whole history behind the Troubles, and honestly, that's a completely separate episode. And one of my takeaways, one of my gleanings from this is that if you don't have the context, it's super hard to understand which side is which, who's promoting what, and more particularly, what justice looks like. So it took me at least half the trip to just start to get the landscape of who was who. For shorthand, the Catholics in Northern Ireland were being discriminated against by the Protestants, which had the backing of London and the United Kingdom. So the Protestants had the money, they had the political power through gerrymandering and hoarding votes and things of that nature. They also had the military power. Catholics had endured discrimination for decades since they partitioned it into Northern Ireland, an act that went into effect in the 1920s. And there was a Northern Ireland civil rights movement, which I didn't really know about. That was one of the most interesting parts to me. And that began in the mid to late 60s. Unfortunately, it quickly devolved into violence, at first initiated by Unionist Protestant forces, but then reciprocated. And so that's another one of the big takeaways here, is that in the case of the Troubles, there was truly a sense of violence on both sides. And so they call these groups paramilitaries, and they waged violent attacks in the form of bombings, kidnappings, lots of other things over the course of decades. And all told, between 3,500 and 3,700 people, depending on what source you look at, were killed, and then thousands more were injured. Now, that we don't play the game of, you know, whose suffering is greater. But we hear that number, you know, 3,600 people killed, and it doesn't sound like a lot in terms of scale. But number one, any life lost to sectarian violence is a tragedy. And number two, the population of Northern Ireland is pretty small. I read one source that said, all told, this would have amounted to about 2% of the population, which proportionally in the United States, that would have been hundreds of thousands of people. So it's a massive, massive loss of life, a massive conflict for a very, very small area. So we were there looking at the Troubles, but more significantly, the end of the Troubles, or at least an end of the Troubles. So in 1998, there was an agreement called the Good Friday Agreement that officially brought an end to the violent hostilities between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. Now, it's complicated. 2023 was the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, and so that prompted a lot of reflection. And there was an article where they were interviewing a professor in Northern Ireland, and I like the way this professor put it. They said, the peace process side of it worked very well. And those who wanted to destroy the agreement and start a conflict again have very little purchase. But the constitutional side, the new institutions, have not worked out as well. So while there's been mostly an end to the violence, although a short time after the Good Friday Agreement was signed, there was a car bomb that killed 29 people and injured dozens more. And that was the most people killed in a single attack in the Troubles. So there was this backlash to the agreement. But largely, that sort of ongoing armed conflict has ceased. But in terms of the civil rights and the justice aspects of it, and even contending over the memory, I think, in my view, of the Troubles, that is still very much contested territory. So enough of the history and the context. There's a lot more to say, but let me dive into just some of the highlights from the trip. There was way too much for me to tell you every single thing we did, but I'll tell you some of the things that I took a lot of pictures of and that I'm going to remember for a really long time. So one of the first places we visited was the Corrymeela community, and it was founded in 1965 by a Presbyterian minister by the name of Ray Davey. Davey had been like a relief worker during World War II. He'd seen the destruction of this conflict and dedicated himself to peacemaking so that stuff like that wouldn't happen in the future. And along with a few others, he founded the community of Corrymeela. To give you a little bit of Minister Davey's mentality, a quote is, if we Christians do not speak about reconciliation, then we have nothing to say. So he founded Corrymeela as sort of a living demonstration of reconciliation. And the tagline from their website says, transform division through human encounter. So to me, the place kind of feels like a retreat center. It's on this gorgeous setting right on the coast. They have this small complex of buildings, and folks come and visit there. Pilgrims, scholars. There's also an element of relief work there. So people who need, you know, refreshing and rejuvenation and replenishing, they can go there and sort of be ministered to. But it's an entire site dedicated to bringing people together for the cause of peacemaking, reconciliation. I think it's a really neat demonstration of how shared community can lead to shared understanding. Most of the places we went were somehow directly related to peacemaking, but this next place I'm going to tell you about was just a tourist attraction, and I loved it. It's called the Giant's Causeway. I did a little bit of research because I couldn't for the life of me fathom what I was seeing. The Giant's Causeway is composed of 40,000 hexagonally shaped basalt columns that go back to the volcanic age 60 million years ago. To give you a visual, these are stone columns naturally formed that can be dozens of feet tall, and they're perfectly shaped hexagons. It's almost like a human being or a computer program had carved them out of stone, but they're naturally occurring. And it was a gorgeous sight, just a million pictures there. But also there's this fun Irish legend that talks about this Irish giant named Finn McCool who picked a fight with a Scottish giant named Benan Donner. And legend has it that this is straight from the Giant's Causeway website. But legend has it that the giants loathed each other. And so one day, after enduring insults from the Scottish giant Benan Donner, the Irish giant Finn built a path to use as stepping stones to reach Scotland and go fight him. But that pathway was ripped up by Brendan Donner, and the result was the Giant's Causeway. Anyway, you can go visit the website. There's more to this story, but it was fun, fanciful. They even had a little animated movie showing it. And so that's a really wonderful site to visit. Another cool site to visit, and to me the most impactful, was when we went to Derry. I've heard of Derry, but I had no context for it. But you might if you've watched the comedy series Derry Girls. So Derry Girls is based in Derry, and it's based in it takes place in the 1990s. So this is still in the midst of the Troubles. And it's about like high schoolers coming of age in the town of Derry. And it sort of pokes fun in the way only comedy can at the conflict between Catholics and Protestants, as well as just life growing up as a teenager in that environment. Now, I didn't know about this show, or maybe I'd heard of it, but I haven't watched it. I plan to. But there's a whole mural of the main characters of Derry Girls. That's a great picturesque spot. And there's even an official city Derry Girls tour of Derry. But that's the fun stuff. There's a deeper, very politicized, very violent history and context to Derry. So even, it goes back 400 years. So there's this gorgeous old stone wall surrounding a portion of the city that's about a mile in circumference. And that dates all the way back to the 1600s and conflicts between British and Irish. This was essentially a colonized area, not just Derry, but all of Northern Ireland. And this wall has a lot of different symbolism and meaning, depending on whether you're Catholic or Protestant. And then the name. So it's called Derry, but it's also called Londonderry, which dates back to, again, to the 1600s when King James I, the British king, made it an official city of Britain. And so if you say Derry, you're probably on the Catholic Republican side of things. If you say Londonderry, you're probably on the Protestant Unionist side of things. So even the name, how you refer to the town, has political implications. But the part that stuck out most to me was the Free Derry Museum, or the Museum of Free Derry. And from the website, it says the museum is the people's story of government oppression, the struggle for civil rights, the descent into conflict, Free Derry and Bloody Sunday. So that term Free Derry means a dairy that is free, free of British control. And there was a sign during the Troubles that was painted on, they call it a gable, was painted on the side of a wall that says, "You are now entering Free Derry." And they had set up a blockade to keep British law enforcement out. And it worked for several weeks. And it was protesting sort of British repression of the local Catholic population, Protestant repression, right? Derry had its own Bloody Sunday. So there's the Bloody Sunday that took place on the march from Selma to Montgomery and the Edmund Pettus Bridge that we're familiar with in the United States. But a few years later, on 30 January 1972, see how I put the date in front of the month like they do in, Europe. Anyway, 30 January 1972, there was a march in Derry to protest internment, which was the largely Protestant police force imprisoning people without a trial and sometimes without even having committed a crime, just being suspected for a crime. So there was this march to protest that internment policy that turned bloody. At the end of the day, this march of 15,000 people were confronted by force and violence from the British Army's parachute regiment. 13 people were killed that day. A 14th person died from his injuries, and several more were injured. And that is a sort of seminal moment in the Troubles that led to even more violence. But that also marked Derry. I mean, it's part of the historical memory there. And the Museum of Free Derry details it. And when I tell you the parallels I could see between the protests and the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland and the civil rights movement in the U.S. South and the United States as a whole, I mean, they adopted as their sort of theme song, "We Shall Overcome." The posters that they used, I say even the font resembled some of the posters like you would see at the March on Washington. Some of the tactics they used, like marching, were inspired by the U.S. civil rights movement. That's an area of study that I'm eager to dive into even more. So that was Derry. We also went to Clonard Monastery, which for me personally was extremely powerful. I was never Catholic, but I had went to Catholic schools all my life. And going to Clonard Monastery, gorgeous church, the stained glass windows, the cavernous ceilings, the beautiful tile, and the liturgy we worshiped there on a Saturday night. It was spiritually satisfying to me in a way that church has not been in a very long time, because it's been such a struggle for me to go back to church and experience it as a place of refuge, given that it has been a place of so much racial trauma for several years now. But for some reason, and I totally wasn't expecting this, going into Clonard that night, hearing a very brief homily, but the prayers, themes of peacemaking and reconciliation and unity, it was just what I needed. And it was very beautiful. And the next morning, we went to a Protestant church. Fits something. It'll come to me. We went to a Protestant church that actually Clonard had partnered with during the Troubles, which was very rare and very subversive at the time. And they still maintain a partnership to this day. So we went and we worshiped there as well. Again, sort of a demonstration of peacemaking and coming together between Christian groups. So that was powerful. I got to tell you about YouthLink and Joe, the director of YouthLink, which is reaching out to young people in the area across sectarian divides. And he had this stirring testimony of he's Catholic and being so loath to and averse to Protestants and the British that he couldn't even touch the flag. And he told us this story of being encouraged by someone at an event to touch the flag as a way of disempowering the hate and the stereotypes. And he did it. And he told us he was weeping because he couldn't even fathom touching it. And when he did, just the ability to have this tangible piece of fabric that represented so much lose some of its power and some of the grip on his heart. And that, I think, for many of us was one of the most powerful testimonies, stories of impact around peacemaking and reconciliation that we heard the entire trip. And then I could go on and on, but let me just mention, we also went to Stormont, which was sort of the parliament in Belfast. And gorgeous building, gorgeous marble and statues and tall ceilings and columns, and it looks just so stately, but it's also tainted by the fact that, you know, like, this is the seat of empire. This was the stronghold of colonialism in Northern Ireland. And for so long, so many unjust laws came from the place. So it kind of, you had that going in the back of your mind, even as you looked at the beauty of the building. So that, you know, I'm still sort of just stunned that I got to go, and I didn't have time to get into it, but I met so many amazing people on this trip, and thankfully it's not the last time. So going forward, what we're going to do is, you know, it's pretty open-ended, but we're supposed to do something with this in the realm of like peacemaking and worship. For me, I want to look deeper into those continuities and discontinuities between the Northern Ireland civil rights movement and the U.S. civil rights movement, particularly around Bloody Sundays and what that means for each group. But there are others who are going to do musical projects, sermons, liturgies. So you'll see more about that. And I'm looking forward to gathering again with this group, this time stateside, in August to further process what we learned and some of the products that we've produced from it. So that's my trip to Northern Ireland. You can check out my Instagram and Facebook pages for pictures. I have tons of pictures, but I tried to just select a few of the highlights. And you'll be hearing more from me about the dynamics of peacemaking, the troubles, and what we can learn in the United States from these things. I think, at minimum, a couple takeaways. Conflicts between people groups are seldom proportional and equal. One group tends to have the power and one group tends to be disempowered. So like I say, justice takes sides. It took me a really long time to wrap my head around the Catholics as a persecuted group historically, and Protestants, Unionists, enacting a lot of the violence, or at least initiating it. But also, conflicts are different. So in the U.S., there were radical leftist groups, but they were pretty effectively repressed by the government and law enforcement, so that it wasn't this tit for tat violence. But that is what happened in the Troubles in Northern Ireland. There were paramilitary groups on both sides. And so both sides legitimately are grieving the murder of loved ones and community members and neighbors. And that's a different dimension than you see in the United States, in this conflict between black and white racism. There also wasn't that sort of color aspect to it. By and large, you're dealing with white people who look white. And that was another really confusing aspect, is like, how do you know who's Catholic and who's Protestant? How do you know who's nationalist or unionist? How do you know? You can't really just tell. But there were a whole bunch of cultural cues, from the colors you wore, from red, white, and blue to represent the United Kingdom, to versus the green, orange, and white to represent the Republic of Ireland, to what church you went to what part of town you lived in, because there's Catholic parts of town, Protestant parts of town, what school you went to, because there's Catholic schools and Protestant schools. So if you're familiar with the culture, there's many ways to tell who is who, even though everybody's skin is pretty much the same color, although there's an increasing immigrant population there. The other thing I noticed as a takeaway is the prevalence of intergenerational trauma. 25 years on from the Good Friday Agreement, people are still reeling from 30 years of conflict and a prehistory that's much longer than that. But even though there's an entire generation that was born post Good Friday Agreement, they're haunted by it too, because their parents and grandparents still bear those wounds. And there's still a reticence on the part of many on both sides to talk about the violence, because it's too painful, because it's too charged, right? And the land itself, the cities and the places, they're still marked by the scars of this conflict. So it's not going away, even with this peace agreement. And then lastly is the role of religion in it. Like I said at the top of the show, Catholic and Protestant are largely political terms when it comes to Northern Ireland, but These are folks who are claiming a religious identity. They're claiming a Christian identity. And it illustrates the duality that in the name of religion, so much violence, so much bloodshed occurred. But it was also religious leaders, both Catholic and Protestant, who were integral to the peacemaking process. They formed civil rights organizations. They had secret meetings to try to come to an accord and peace, even though getting caught could very well mean harm to their lives and their loved ones. So against great odds, you had people coming together because of religion to try to make peace and to try to reconcile and to try to end the violence and to try to bring out equality and equity between peoples. And I think that's similar all over the world, that religion is a tool of violence, but it's also an instrument of peace. And it highlights the necessity of all of us to do as Jesus said, to be peacemakers. And then we will be called children of God. Thanks for listening to this episode of Footnotes. I'll catch you next time.
This episode was brought to you in part by the Truce Podcast. The new season examines the connection between some evangelicals and the Republican Party with the help of world-class historians. Subscribe to Truce in your podcast app or listen at trucepodcast.com.